which is our marshal has the clock up. So the case, which is our third case this morning and the last one on our oral calendar, is A19-1959 Jean Baki. How is that pronounced?
Baki, Your Honor.
Baki versus A.W. Well, Conwood, I'm not sure. A.W. Kudel and Conwood. And the counsel, can you, counsel for appellant, can you identify yourself, please?
Steve Kirsch, K-I-R-S-C-H, for Conwood.
And for respondent?
Chet Alexander, Your Honor.
Great. Okay. Everyone can, we can see and hear you fine. Counsel, you're good to go. You can see and hear everybody, or me at least. Great.
Yes.
Okay. So if you can, we as a rule put the microphone on mic when we're not speaking. So when you're not speaking, if you can try and remember to do that. Microphone on mute. I don't know if I said that right. But in any event, you each have 15 minutes. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes rebuttal if you choose to use it. And so, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready. And just again, if you could restate your name and the party you represent for the record.
If it please the court, Mr. Alexander, my name is Steve Kirsch, and I represent Conwood. Good morning to all. Our case here talks about the three factors enunciated in Pecoraro and in Johnson. And our position is that based on those three factors, there's no Minnesota contacts at the time the plaintiff's claim arose, at the time the lawsuit was filed, or within a reasonable period of time immediately prior to the filing of the suit. As to the third part, as we go through the cases, I think the courts will give a definition of what that third part means. I would like to point out, so there's no misunderstanding, in the plaintiff's complaint on page 3, they allege that the defendants are presently doing business in the state of Minnesota, and I don't think there's going to be any dispute that since 1985, Conwood has left the state. Valspar Corporation in 1992 indicated that Minnesota appellate courts instruct the district courts to apply federal law. There's no requirement when the district court applies federal law that it applies the U.S. Supreme Court. We will admit that the U.S. Supreme Court is silent on the stale contact temporal relationship that we're talking about here. The Eighth Circuit in 1965, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this, had a case called Aftansi. I'm not sure that's the correct pronunciation, but the Minnesota Supreme Court adopted the five-factor minimum contact rule on hard drives in 1976. There is, as we point out on the bottom of page 12, there is no requirement that the Minnesota appellate courts follow the Eighth Circuit, but Eighth Circuit cases should be given persuasive authority and due deference. Prior to the
This is Judge Riley. Can you hear me?
I can, Judge.
Have you, I was unable to find any Minnesota court that used the test that you're suggesting we use. And as recently as Bandemir, our Supreme Court is still looking at the hard drive's five factors.
And that's fine. The only Minnesota, I don't think the Minnesota Supreme Court has addressed it, the stale contact issue, but your court has in two cases. And I'm gonna get to those in just a moment, but you're correct on the Minnesota Supreme Court. The district courts of Minnesota in 2007, 2012, and then the McGill case did address it. I think McGill, and Your Honor, I'll talk about the Minnesota appellate court cases in a moment. In McGill, which is really a dry run on Baki, Judge Nelson followed Pecoraro, and Pecoraro and Johnson I'll use interchangeably.
Before counsel, maybe before we get to the McGill case, let's spend a second on Pecoraro, because I want to understand that case, because you've referenced it and it seems to be quite right anchored to that decision. As I read that decision, and it was a pretty brief one. The Eighth Circuit looked at two different defendants and whether there were the contacts necessary. And with respect to Sky Ranch, which was the camp, as I read it, it just went right to the 1960s, 1970s conduct, analyzed that, and decided that there was jurisdiction. And then when it turned to the foundation, it appears, one can infer from the foundation, that it looked at fundraising activities around 2001 to 2002. It didn't talk about whether the foundation was even around in the 60s, but it didn't make any analysis with respect, I don't think, with respect to Sky Ranch as to what happened in 2001, 2002 when the cause of action accrued.
Pecoraro, even if you read it three or four times, there are some loose ends there, but for the purposes of the Eighth Circuit, it did apply those factors and found that there was a connection to the state immediately before filing. There was some contact, whether it's fundraising, but those...
But not for Sky Ranch. I don't think it did for Sky Ranch, which said, okay, what happened in this state by Sky Ranch in the 1960s? It didn't really evaluate whether any of those contacts were stale, it seemed to me.
They evaluated the contacts, though, of the diocese and found that there was no jurisdiction for that because there wasn't a temporal relationship. It was like 36 years.
Right. I guess my question is, why isn't this case more like Sky Ranch, where you look at activities in the state that give rise to the cause of action, even if it hasn't yet accrued by virtue of the later discovery of the harm? Isn't this more like what happened with Sky Ranch, where the Eighth Circuit just evaluated what happened at the time of the conduct?
With respect to the diocese and with respect to the fundraising, I'm unclear on the decision with respect to that particular defendant, but they did look at the diocese.
Oh, shoot.
And stale.
I'm going to ask you to, we've lost, with, I don't, I'm not, yeah, my question, and we lost you just for a second, so you might have to repeat it. There are three defendants in that case. There's Sky Ranch, there's a foundation, the diocese. For Sky Ranch, there was, of course, jurisdiction. I'm saying, why isn't this more like the analysis of the Sky Ranch? Leave aside the diocese and the foundation.
If the Sky Ranch and the foundation were doing business at or near the time of the litigation, that's different from this case.
Sky Ranch wasn't determined to be doing, there was no, I guess I didn't see anything in the case that said Sky Ranch was doing business in 2001, 2002.
Yeah. And
I'm 1960s conduct. But I'll let you continue. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but that's why I read it.
Your Honor, I had a note that said the camp and the foundation were found to have present minimal activity. But I don't have the case right in front of me. So that's all I can tell you right there.
Okay.
Going back to McGill, I think that's a dry run here on Bakke. And the factors of Pecoraro will put in. Bakke had exposure in the early 60s. But 2018 is when he was diagnosed. 2019 is when he started the lawsuit. And Judge Nelson went through all of the factors that really exist here. If you substitute Kansas from Minnesota, Mr. McGill was in Kansas, had his exposure in Kansas. Mr. Bakke had his exposure in Minnesota. There aren't many differences between the two of them, but I would like to point out, if I may, so I don't get it wrong, Judge Nelson, in her order, said when the cause of action arose and the court again concludes that Conwed's contacts during that time do not give rise to specific jurisdiction, it's undisputed in that case that the plaintiff's claim arose in 2015, and the court held Conwed had no contemporary contacts that could subject it to personal jurisdiction in Minnesota. And I think the analogy in McGill does apply here.
Well, Mr. Kirsch, this is Judge Riley. I think your argument would be more persuasive if McGill had been Bakke's coworker in Grand Rapids or wherever at that mill.
Well, Your Honor, the We focused on due process and specific.
McGill didn't have any contact with Minnesota. He wasn't a Minnesota citizen, didn't work here, didn't live here, didn't come here for recreation. He had no the plaintiff in that case had no contacts with Minnesota, as I read the case.
Other than being in contact with a product that was manufactured, sold, and shipped from Minnesota, you're right. But we're talking about Bakke's contacts right now. And the case law, which is cited in our brief, is pretty clear. It's the relationship the defendant has to the forum that is even more important than the plaintiff's relationship to the forum. And that gets back into the three factors from the Eighth Circuit. When I say Eighth Circuit, I'm talking about Pecoraro and Johnson. Johnson was a breach of contract case, and they found that from the time of the breach, it was stale. And consequently, those line of cases. Let me comment, getting back to Judge Riley's talk about what's been cited in Minnesota. The Namaji case by the appellate court in 2013 did do a discussion about the Pecoraro and Johnson decisions. And in there, they talked about Johnson might diminish the present significance of much of the alleged pre-2009 contacts, but had a present connection, the defendant had a present connection to the state. They even talked about the 5-year gap may have been stale, but it doesn't matter because there was a present connection. We agree with that. Trivedi was written on by your court, and you went through Pecoraro and found that the complaint was a year after, or the contacts were a year after the complaint was filed, and you analyzed that factor under the three-prong test, and properly so, found that there was jurisdiction. Both of those cases, I believe, substantively discussed the two Eighth Circuit cases. And the plaintiffs talked about, does this apply to asbestos cases? And on page 27 of our brief, we did talk about McQueen versus Union Carbide in Delaware, and that was an asbestos case. So as we, just a second, Your Honor, my screen is, okay, thank you. So we talk about citations of Pecoraro and Johnson. We talk about the cases that have been cited over the years. And in addition to the Minnesota District Court, obviously the Eighth Circuit has adopted it, and so has Nebraska, and so has, these are district court, Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, Delaware, Arkansas, and even Pennsylvania. And I would represent that I believe the two cases I cited for the Minnesota Appellate Court are also cases that have been recognized by the Minnesota Appellate Court case, and they did apply Pecoraro and Johnson to their analysis. I don't believe in the plaintiff's opposition brief they cited cases that specifically rebutted the theory of the three-prong test.
Counsel, can you tell me, can you tell me this? What case is like this, any case that you cited, where the parties were both in a state and the harm was alleged to have taken place in a state? So everything was in the state, and the only difference is then the defendant left the state and it became stale. Is there any case that you can point to that would hold what you're asking us to hold here?
I'm trying to think if Johnson stayed in Minnesota and the defendant left. If I may, Your Honor, I'll get back to that because off the top, I have to go through in my mind these cases. Nothing pops up right now, and I just want to make sure because McGill is the closest thing to the Bakke case, but as you pointed out, McGill was exposed in Kansas and was a Kansas resident. But again, where the plaintiff is from isn't as important as the defendant's connection to the forum. In any event, the reasonable period of time immediately prior to the filing of the suit, in the Johnson case, it was 20 to 30 years stale, Pecoraro 36, Nimmer 20, and then our brief had some Iowa District Court cases that go from 4 years to several decades. So that's a little guidance on what the appellate courts think a reasonable period of time immediately prior is. So what protection does the Minnesota courts give to defendants? The Minnesota courts can't provide less protection than the U.S. Constitution, but may provide greater protection. That is State versus Edstrom, which is cited in our brief. Patterson Dental, I think one of you will recognize that case. Patterson Dental, in the 2016 appellate court, was a trade secret case, but it stated for the rule of law in that, quote, Minnesota long-arm statute extends personal jurisdiction over non-resident defendants to the limits of federal due process. And there's other cases that have been cited for that. We believe that Conwed should get the protection that federal due process gives us, and that would be the Eighth Circuit. One of the cases cites Walden versus Fiore, a 2014 U.S. Supreme Court case. And when they talked about jurisdiction and the forum, they stated, quote, however significant the plaintiff's contacts with the forum may be, those contacts can't be decisive in determining whether the defendant's due process rights are violated. So yes, you can talk about Mr. Bakke being in Minnesota and being exposed in Minnesota, and I get that, but the Eighth Circuit three factors don't put that as the highest factor. And I think I'm out of time, so I'm gonna respect that.
Thank you. Yes, thank you very much for noticing that. You are, and you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Okay, and counsel for respondent, if you could again state your name and the party you represent, you'll have 15 minutes.
Good morning, Your Honor, counsel, Chad Alexander for the Bakkes, Carol and Randy. At page 3 of the transcript of the hearing in the trial court, Conwed admits and concedes that the 5-factor test is met. That's at page 3, it's in our brief. So, you know, really, I think we just move right past that. I mean, I am a very bad golfer, but I can use a driver and hit the golf ball from Randy Bakke, where he's dying right now, to the Conwed plant. Everything that happened in this case, and where Gene Bakke is literally withering to death on his couch, happened within a square mile radius. I find this argument to be absolutely disgraceful. Okay? The Minnesota Secretary of State has a publicly available document from 2007. Conwed reinstated and then withdrew again. So we're not talking about 36 years ago or 1985, just as early as 2007, they reinstated themselves as a corporation in Minnesota. A corporate entity filed and reinstated in Minnesota. You know, time is relative. Randy Bakke couldn't have operated any more quickly than he did after being diagnosed and putting this case in suit. The asbestos fibers that he inhaled in the 60s are still in him. That is why routinely in these cases, the defendants request an autopsy. They take chunks of the lung and they digest them to see what kind of fibers are in the tissue. And Mr. Kirsch knows that. So the contacts are current. They're not stale. The only law that we have to look at here is not, let's forget about this temporal argument. That is not the law of the land. The law of the land in this state is hard drives. And the case that I can't pronounce, so I'll defer to Steve's incorrect pronunciation of that. And let's keep in mind, Conwed knew that asbestos was hazardous in 1959. That's their own document. They knew in 1984, before they sold their plant, that asbestos was hazardous. They wrote a memo outlining the history of the damage they caused and were going to cause. These contacts are relevant. They're timely. Time is relative. I'm sorry that mesothelioma isn't like getting broadsided by a Mack truck. Mr. Bakke did everything he could to put this case in suit as quickly as possible. You know, when we talk about Pecoraro and Judge Smith, I think your recitation of the facts are correct. And we go through that analysis at page 19 of our brief. Conwed can't cite a single case that stands for the proposition they're asking you to adopt now and deprive Mr. Bakke. Oh, wait, no, he can go to New York City. That's right. He's got cancer. He's dying. Go to New York City and have your trial.
Why don't we speak, counsel, if you could just please address the question of whether, I was talking about the analysis in Pecoraro, but there is the language in that case and in other cases about the three, the temporal question about whether at the complaint was filed within a reasonable period of time or when the claim arose. Why is that not case law? You say it doesn't have any bearing in Minnesota. Why shouldn't it?
Well, listen, let's just assume that it does. Okay. Let's assume that it does have effect in Minnesota. Mr. Bakke should not be deprived because these factors did occur immediately before he filed his complaint in the world of latent diseases that he's one of which he's dying from. This happened. All of these things happened immediately before the complaint was filed. Let's just set aside what we think about as immediate. In the world of science and medicine, in this type of injury, these things did just happen. The cause and effect is there. These are all related contacts. And I don't think it applies. I mean, it came out of a footnote in the Clune decision, which involved a crane that was sold into the state of Missouri, I believe, you know, decades earlier. Then the guy, the plaintiff, dies because of the crane. I can't remember the facts. And the court said, the crane's still here, just like the fibers in Bakke's lungs and pleura. So I don't think it applies because no case can be found where it deprives somebody like Mr. Bakke, where all of the facts happen within a square mile radius, right there. There's no case throwing the guy's, anybody, any plaintiff's case out of court for lack of specific jurisdiction. No case exists. We haven't seen it. Conway hasn't provided us with one. It doesn't apply. I don't know why it showed up in a footnote in Clune, but I think it's time for the courts to stop, you know, batting this thing around. There's no analysis. Let's put it to bed. Our law is hard drives.
Well, one thing that I was wondering is even if we looked at that test, I was wondering what the, and I'll ask this for Mr. Kirsch when you respond, but what the term, even if that applied, what it means that a claim arose. I think the appellant would argue that the claim arises only when it actually accrues at the point of discovery of the injury, whether that's or for example in Pecoraro, where it's a later, well, it was a discovery of the abuse, the trauma of the abuse later. Here it's a discovery of a disease. But is that what measuring when a claim arose, or is it possible that a claim arises at the time that events took place that later are lead to the accrual?
Well, I think there's the law is stated in our brief, and I'm trying to find it. But, you know, these types of injuries are considered a continuing tort. So it's continuing from the time of exposure through manifestation of the disease and filing of the complaint. And I'm trying to find that site. But our position is that this is a continuing tort. And all of the factors involved in that tort occurred in Minnesota. Yeah, that's the DeCosse case, DeCosse, DeCosse v. Armstrong. Courts in asbestos cases have recognized that asbestos exposure is a quote-unquote continuing tort that continues from date of initial exposure until diagnosis of the disease. And that's at pages 48 to 49 of the DeCosse decision. You know, the five factors are met. And, you know, getting to the convenience of the parties, you know, Conwood is a corporation, but it has no employees. It has Steve Kirsch as its attorney and the Brownsons as their corporate attorney. All of these people live in the Twin Cities. Okay. So having New York decide this case, I find ridiculous. Conwood came to Minnesota in the early 1900s. And started, you know, took our trees. It used to be called wood conversion. It used wood products from our forests using our human labor, exposing them to a known deadly poison. And now it's running and saying, "Nanana boo boo, come sue us in New York." It's ridiculous. I have nothing further to say. I'm happy to answer any questions, obviously. Thank you for your time.
Counsel for appellant, rebuttal. I'll let the marshal get the time ready. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Kirsch.
In response to one of the questions earlier, the Johnson case was a contract entered into in Minnesota by Johnson and Woodcock as Minnesota residents. Woodcock left Minnesota. Years later, the contract was breached. That's when really the cause of action arose, and the court found that the stale contacts with the state of Minnesota prevented jurisdiction. That was a Judge Doty case and Eighth Circuit. So that was all Minnesota until the defendant left. With respect to Mr. Alexander's comments about Judge Guthman's statement, as we said in our brief, it left out the first part of my answer. He asked, well, what about hard drives? Hard drives is good law, but if you apply the Eighth Circuit cases, that is answered first before you get to hard drives. If it's stale, the hard drives factors don't matter. And he said, what if I don't apply that? I said, then I would be in a lot of trouble. So that's the entire, I wasn't conceding that we lose the case from the start. I was conceding if the Eighth Circuit cases aren't followed, we're gonna lose the case. And I think this court has already indicated in their analysis on the two cases I mentioned that you have looked at Pecoraro and Johnson and you discussed those factors and you found jurisdiction, and you should have, because in one case the complaint was filed and then the contacts were after, and the other case they were a going concern, just like Ford now in the case that's up on appeal. As to the footnote, as the court is better versed in this than I am, because Mr. O'Neill advised me that footnote 4 in United States versus Caroline Products is known for shaping constitutional law in the future. I read that footnote, and basically it says the Supreme Court's levels of scrutiny arguably originated with footnote 4. There's all kinds of things in that footnote. Whether Kloon is a footnote or not, Pecoraro and Johnson are more than a footnote. They're their own independent cases. And in Walden versus Fiore, the minimum contacts analysis looks to the defendant's contacts with the forum state itself, not the defendant's contacts with the person who resides there. There's so much emphasis, and I get it with Mr. Bakke being in Minnesota, but it's the defendant's connection. The claim arose issue I'm going to talk about, the attorneys in Minnesota, Judge Nelson blocked that out. That's not even alleged in this case. The 1959 memo, well, let me back up. Judge Guthman's order talks about the Steele case in the Ninth Circuit, and that was not in the plaintiff's brief, and I don't know if they advocate Steele or not, but let me just spend a minute on Steele. Steele supports the plaintiff's version that what happened at the time, this tort in 1960s, that would be considered in Steele. Steele, in my opinion, isn't cited as much as the Eighth Circuit cases, but here's the problem and the flaw in Steele. Steele relies on fair warning. Fair warning comes down to one word, foreseeability. And it is our position that the cases support our position that in Minnesota, here's what Minnesota says about foreseeability. In Janssen, your court stated that the Minnesota courts emphasized the Supreme Court's desire to slow the inexorable expansion of jurisdiction in state courts by undermining the significant territoriality. Sherburne County is the Minnesota Supreme Court that held that foreseeability of impact or injury is no longer a valid basis for personal jurisdiction. I don't believe that the Steele case can withstand any scrutiny in Minnesota. And one of the foreseeability cases was Volkswagen, US Supreme Court case. So I wanna, I guess, conclude, Your Honor, by saying, I don't think Steele fits because of the foreseeability issue. I think the Minnesota Appellate Court has already recognized these Eighth Circuit cases. But in the end, I think a quote on page 1784 of Bristol-Myers sums it up. The court's decision will not result in the parade of horribles that respondents conjure up. It does not prevent the California and out-of-state plaintiffs from suing in the states that have general jurisdiction over BMS. This firm represented Mr. McGill in district court, and when it was dismissed, they sued Mr. McGill's lawyer sued the case in Delaware. And that's where, other than New York, you can also go to Delaware. We're at home in Delaware. Thank you. I think I apologize for 18 seconds over.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you both. The case is submitted, and we'll have a decision out in a statutory time period.
Thank you.
We'll be signing off. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Thank you very much.